informant.
Yeah.
See what he thinks about it. This guy here is just a buyer. He just goes around looking, you know. This other one, he wants to get his opinion of it before he gets back in there, because he wants to make sure there's enough back there to get his equipment in there for. So I don't know yet whether he's going to take it. But after that hike, I just assume he would now.
Yes. What about, I mean, about the hike? You all just went way...
We went way down near the swamp, see?
Yeah.
And he looked at the cypress down there. And then we walked up on the higher part so that he could see the pine. And then way back in the back, last 40 acres, I'm back from that barn there, way back near the lake.
Yeah.
And that has a big oak timber on it, and he wants some of that. And then, if he does get it, and then we walk back over here in this 40 acres of oak over here opposite the town.
Yeah.
So we've been really all over the place in just a little while, and I mean, I had a time keeping up with him.
Well, I hope he...
I think he must have been some kind of a race track runner or something.
Did he have his hip boots?
He wore his, and I wore Berman, so we were well protected as far as, you know, the briars and the wet ground, but he was more interested in the pines and the oaks than he was the cypress. And so we didn't walk too much down around the swamp area there, but walking in those boots was a little more than I'm used to.
Yeah.
They're so heavy, so awkward walking.
And you've got a lot of cypress?
Well, he likes the cypress, what's down there, the size of it, but like you said, he wants to be sure that there's enough of a little bit of everything so that it pays him to go in there with his equipment. I can't blame him, because he's got to consider the mileage from here to the mill, too.
Yeah.
So I can't blame him for not giving me that right away. But with all they do cut down, is that much less that we'll have to clear later on. So, you know, it can help get out of the way. So, see if we can get anything out of it. I just, what he wants to do.
And it'd help you, too.
Oh, yes.
And taxes coming up?
Well, for next year.
Oh.
I'm thinking ahead for next year, because it'll take them a while to get this out, I suppose, if they do get it. But no, Berman's gone. He's going to go in today to take care of the taxes for this year.
I see.
He's just let them go until the last minute, so he told me breakfast this morning. He thought he's going to get that taken care of, but I don't know, anything we can get out of the place to help her to go toward taxes for the next year, I think we're going to try to get it, because they keep going up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, I'm out of breath.
Yeah, well, I know you are. Well, we surely did enjoy that, your visit over here, and we'll check with you again and find a day.
How's your mama's knee doing?
Well, it's better.
Good.
Uh-huh. It's better. And she's still here, and we wanted you to come over while, you know, after all, we didn't get that lunch, so we'll cash in on it.
Well, I want to have you all come over to have dinner with me one day.
Well, we won't worry about that, but we'll see you.
All right.
And thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
And the administration's Middle East policy. CBS News diplomatic correspondent Marvin Cowell reports. One after another.
I can't walk from Gail from the hospital. She ain't going to be able to. Don't worry. Oh, Lordy. Yeah.
Well, your daddy
see
Jake gonna bring the fish.
Okay, all right.
You can't bring the fish until some of them children come from school.
Well, she, I don't know. She may come back. I don't know. You know, she might have just went.
Well,
with...
if she come back before you leave, you could call me and let me know.
Well.
Because Jake got, see, I ain't got no place to put the fish.
Yeah, well.
And it got to be on ice.
Yeah, well, just, can you put them in the refrigerator?
Well, that's what I'm going to have to do.
In your ice box. Yeah,
She got a big fish, ain't she?
I don't know. You know I don't know.
Well, I got one, but mine's full.
Yeah,
That's why I ain't got no
Well, he did them. Let them make arrangements to keep them.
Let Buddy come up there to the place for him. He can come with Buddy. Buddy can put them up there.
Well, tomorrow ain't.
I forgot about that.
Tomorrow, I mean, it's just tomorrow, so
yeah,
they ain't going
to be tomorrow. afternoon so they could settle me somewhere that's keep cool.
Yeah,
right.
Come on. Yeah, he could take him up there.
Buddy take him up there. Just in case I'm the buddy then. And she don't come home.
Yeah.
Because I know that fool gal wouldn't know what to do with him.
No, she wouldn't know no huh?
Or don't.
Well,
okay, I'll see you. Well, you call me anywhere. You come in if you can't get me, come in. So I know if a car will come back or whatever.
All right.
Then. Don't be raining too hard
now. Okay, well, you can run out the way. Put your raincoat on.
Another way I do, I'll get in the car with up under the carpool.
Yeah, oh yeah,
Yeah,
all right then, I'll catch up with you later.
Okay,
then. All right, bye.
I'm glad you called,
yeah.
Okay,
bye.
She might try to come to the phone. Well, he said that he was trying to hope maybe she felt a little bit better.
A little better.
Yeah, he didn't know, though. He said that...
Now, it's tomorrow she goes to...
That's what I understood, Cora, that she'd go back tomorrow.
That's what I thought Cora said.
Well, he said she's still sick. Just soon as she's taking that antibiotic, I think she got sicker. He said he... got her in the living room. She's sitting in the chair. I don't guess so, you know. I wouldn't think so. This doctor name that wants to see her tomorrow is named Dr. Barefoot.
B-A-B-E-R-S?
It's Barefoot. No, Barefoot. No, I think she goes back to that one tomorrow. I don't imagine she'll go to Dr. Strange because he sent her up there.
Yes. Well, I do hope she
will. Oh, I do too. I sure hope that she don't have another one of them.
Oh, I do too.
Gloria said that wasn't nothing but a diabetic coma. Because you should know they know a lot about it.
I imagine that's it.
Yeah, that was what it was. And she said they do call them blackouts.
I know years ago, Mrs. Hatchett had one like that, and Dr. Strange took her to Tampa. Because a long time ago, because
he's
been dead for
good. Well, I tell you, I think they could kill you because anybody's sugar was up that high. Ooh, I hope I don't never have nothing like that.
I hope I won't
leave,
but you don't know what.
I told Flora this morning, I said we can just find something worse off than what we got after all. Because that thing is so worse than about something to eat. I know Ice is not getting what she ought to have to eat. You know, somebody was listening to us. Did you hear the television?
Yes.
Yeah, somebody had received all. They must have not liked this conversation.
Well, we've had no harm about anybody.
No, well, listen, did you want anything from Gangel?
Oh, yes, I did, Miss Jackson.
Well, Coco said if it cleared up, got to where she could, see, she's got men, that she probably would go sometime.
She didn't get to go yesterday?
No, she stayed right with them.
Yes, I know that. I called Neil, and he didn't think that. Said he didn't know that his mother was going to Ocala. I mean, his grandmother, his mama, that he hadn't said anything to her. And I said, well, I don't believe she is. And they haven't called back or anything. And Elaine and Sally are not coming.
They're not?
Because Bob is to come today, or he's already gotten there.
Oh, my goodness.
He went there yesterday. And Sally had something on hand, and too, Bob had come. Oh,
was
coming today. I don't know
which. Well, Mary have to carry Neil back.
Huh?
Mary will have to carry Neil back. I say, I reckon Mary will have to take Neil back.
Well, he said either that or he'd go on the train. I told him it'd be his last time to go on.
Yeah, sure will. Well, I guess we better let him have it, Miss John. Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Who? Duck. Who is this speaking?
This is Robert.
Oh, well, this is Louise. You know where they playing at this weekend?
Let's see.
Live Oaks Minor?
Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you. Paul Harvey. You know, in the business of news analysis, we usually try to determine where we're going by taking a good analytical look at how we got where we are. And I have been reading from the Bible story, the story of the young prophet, Daniel. Now, you remember that Daniel had been taken from his country home in Judah to the faraway country of Babylon. And during the last terrible days when Jerusalem was captured by the Babylonians, this was a dreadful time for his people, the long siege with its hunger and fear and despair and the breaking down of the city gates, you remember, the dead bodies of friends and loved ones, the screaming women, the frightened children. And now in prison, all this was a nightmare to Daniel, remembering how the prisoners had been seized and bound, recalling the dreadful march across the desert to Babylon, the blows and the curses of the conquerors, and now finally prison. Well, as the morning sun shone through the grating above their heads, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah began to realize what a sad, sad thing had happened to them. You see, all four belonged to good families in Judah. From childhood, they had enjoyed the best of everything. Now they had nothing, not even their freedom. And as they talked together, surely they asked each other, how did it all happen? And then they remembered the warnings of Jeremiah, that just such punishments would surely come if the people did not give up their idols and turn again to God. Perhaps right there in prison, the four young men asked God's forgiveness for their sins and made up their minds to be true to him always, no matter what the Babylonians might do to them. One day, the prison door opened, and an officer named Ashpenaz came in. He looked over the prisoners. He picked out Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. At first, they wondered why. Had they done something wrong? Then Ashpenaz explained that Nebuchadnezzar was a great and far-seeing king. He did not kill all his captives. Instead, he chose the best of them, those who appeared strong and healthy and intelligent, and educated them in the schools of Babylon so that they might become a strength to the country in the days to come. Well, the four boys, he said, should consider themselves very fortunate, for they were among the few chosen for this honor. But then they began to worry when Ashpenaz told them that their names would have to be changed. Henceforth, they would have Babylonian, not Hebrew names. Daniel was given the name Belshazzar, and Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, and Azariah, Abednego. Well, from this it seemed clear that their masters meant to change them completely. They were to forget they were Hebrews and become a part of Babylon. And then came the first big test. King Nebuchadnezzar gave orders that the captives who had been chosen should be fed from the king's table. In other words, they would eat what he ate. No doubt the king thought that he was doing the captives a very great favor in providing them a portion of the king's meat and the wine which he drank. But Daniel and his friends were troubled. They felt they couldn't eat the meat that was prepared for the king. For one thing, probably it was first offered to idols. And as for the wine, it was fermented and full of alcohol, so they couldn't drink that. Was it worth fussing about? After all, it was only food and drink. Maybe they could take just a little to avoid offending the king. But Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with even a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which the king drank. He felt that if he were to yield on this point, then he would eventually tend to give way on everything. He could never take a stand on anything else. And so Daniel plucked up his courage. He spoke to Ashpenaz. Would it be all right if they had something else, he asked. Nothing special, just vegetables and cereals, food, plain water to drink. Ashpenaz listened carefully. He liked this young man, but he was worried. He didn't see how it could be done. I fear my lord the king, he said. If you don't eat the food he has provided and you become thinner than the rest of the boys, he may take my head off. And Daniel knew how easily this could happen. And yet he somehow felt sure that all would be well. He said, just let us try it for 10 days. Give us pulse to eat and water to drink. And then look us over and you do what seems best. Finally, he explained it all to Melzar, whom Ashpenaz had put in charge of the food, and with many misgivings, Melzar at last agreed. Instead of the king's meat and wine, he gave them vegetables and cereals and water. You can imagine how they were watched day after day for the first signs of weakness, but they didn't fall sick, nor did their faces grow thin and pale. Instead, at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter of the flesh than all of the children which did eat of the portion of the king's meat. From now on, he gladly gave the four boys the food they wanted, and somehow they were able to think more clearly than the others. Living on a clean, simple diet, they were able to gather knowledge and wisdom faster than all of the rest put together. At the end of 3 years, they were graduated from the school with highest honors. As a special reward, they were presented to King Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them. Therefore stood they before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding, the king inquired of them. He found them 10 times better than all of the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. This is what happened to them because they purposed in their hearts to be true to God. The magicians and the astrologers who thronged Nebuchadnezzar's court and advised the king how to rule his empire, of course, they were not pleased at the arrival of Daniel and his friends, but it was not long before they changed their minds about them. One morning, when the king took his seat upon the golden throne, he had a troubled look. Rumors spread that he'd had a bad night and was in a very ugly mood, that something had upset him. This was very clear. Suddenly the king roused himself from his deep thought and snapped out a command. "Summon my counselors," he commanded. "Bring them all, the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans." Well, instantly the servants all went into action. The king's command was carried by runners to all of the wise men of Babylon. One by one, the counselors filed into the throne room and they stood before the king. They all noticed his troubled appearance, and they were all prepared for the worst. And when the king spoke, were they surprised? He had not called them to consider any bad news from any part of his kingdom, nor did he want to talk about raising money for some great building scheme. He just wanted to tell them about a dream he'd had. Well, at this, everybody gave a sigh of relief. But only a dream that was troubling the king. They could soon put his mind at ease. They were experts at spinning yarns about people's dreams. If they could just learn the dream, they could easily give him some explanation for it. Well, unfortunately, the king could not remember his dream. He demanded that the wise men tell him his dream. Now, the Chaldeans and the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers looked at each other in alarm. Nobody had ever asked them to do such a thing as this before. How could they know what a man had dreamed the night before? And they didn't dare guess. They might have been wrong. "I'll pay you well if you tell me," said the king. "I will see that you have gifts and rewards and great honor. But if you don't, believe me, you shall be torn limb from limb and your houses shall be laid in ruins." The men pleaded with the king that he reveal his dream. But again, he told them that he'd forgotten it. And they said, "There's not a man on earth that can do what you ask of us. And there is no king, lord, or ruler that asks such things of any magician." Well, at this, Nebuchadnezzar became furious, angry, and he gave orders that all of the wise men of Babylon should be killed. For some reason or other, Daniel and his three friends were not present with the other wise men when the king gave orders that all should be killed. And there was a loud knock on the door, and opening it, they saw Arioch, the chief of executioners, with a strong bodyguard of soldiers. "What's the matter?" asked Daniel innocently, not knowing what had happened. "Why is the decree so hasty from the king?" Well, Arioch then told him what had taken place. He was sorry, but orders were orders. Daniel and his friends would have to go with him. Respectfully, Daniel asked if he might see the king first and beg for a little time. Arioch agreed to this, so Daniel went to see the king, promising him that if only he could have a little time, he would tell him all that he wanted to know. Angry though he had been with the Chaldeans, the astrologers, the magicians, and the sorcerers, the king's heart softened at the sight of this noble youth. He did not want Daniel to be killed. and so he agreed to give him some time. That night, there was a wonderful prayer meeting. Those four boys pleaded with God, please, to help them and soon, before the king's deadline should pass. Can't you hear them crying out, dear God, tell us that dream. Tell us what it means. Do not fail us. And that night, Daniel saw the very same thing that Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his dream. And as the marvelous picture passed before his eyes, its meaning suddenly became plain to him. In the morning, Daniel could hardly wait to tell the king what God had shown him. But first he told his friends, and together they thanked God. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, said Daniel, for wisdom and might are his. Well, now, Daniel hurried to Arioch, the chief executioner, with the good news. Destroy not the wise men of Babylon, he urged. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king an interpretation of his dream. The look on Daniel's face and a gleam in his eye told Arioch that the young man meant what he said, and so Arioch brought in Daniel before the king. Trying to take a little glory for himself, the chief executioner said, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. But the king took no notice of Arioch. His eyes were fixed on that splendid youth who stood before him. He had seen him the day before, and now here he was back again. What would he say? And Daniel's great moment had come. Calmly he spoke to the king. In your dream, you were thinking about things to come to pass hereafter. You saw a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before you, and the form thereof was terrible. The king almost leaped from his throne. That was it. That was the very thing he had been trying so hard to recall. A huge metallic man. And it had stood by his bed and glared down at him. He would never forget this as long as he lived. This image's head was of fine gold, continued Daniel. His breast and arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part iron and part clay. It's exactly it, cried the king. That is precisely what I saw. Yes, said Daniel, and you watched it? Till a stone, cut out without hands, smote the image upon the feet that were of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the winds carried them away that no place was found for them. That's right, said the king. The whole thing suddenly disappeared. Just as though the wind had blown it all away. Yes, and that stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth, said Daniel. It did, cried the king. He was just overcome with amazement. Nebuchadnezzar could hardly wait to learn the meaning of this strange and terrible thing which he had seen. Why did it have a head of gold? Why were the feet of iron and clay? Why was it broken to pieces? Why did it vanish so suddenly? In the same calm, serious voice, Daniel went on to tell Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of the strange image. You are this head of gold, he said. A smile of satisfaction kind of flickered on the king's face, don't you imagine? He was flattered that the glory of his empire should be mentioned first. But Babylon, strong and proud though it was at the moment, would not last forever. Said Daniel, after you shall arise another kingdom, though not so great as yours. Now this was the meaning of the breast and arms of silver. Then a third empire would arise, pictured by the belly and thighs of brass. This in turn would be overthrown by a fourth kingdom, strong as iron like the two legs of the image, as the feet and toes were made part of iron and part of clay, so the fourth kingdom would be divided into several kingdoms, some of them weak, some of them strong, and they would remain divided until the God of heaven, the King of Kings, should set up his everlasting kingdom. Well, as Daniel talked on, Nebuchadnezzar forgot that he was sitting on the throne, of Babylon, it seemed to him that he was standing at an open window, looking down the ages upon the great events of history yet to be. And of course he was. Both king and prophet were looking through the window of the future. Before them stretched the wondrous panorama of all the years yet to come. And close by them, they saw the golden temples of Babylon, but beyond, stretching far into the distance, were the silver minarets of Medo-Persia, the brazen towers of Grecia, the iron domes of Rome. On down the ages they peered, until they saw the mighty Roman Empire divided into the nations of modern Europe. They saw these nations fighting one with another in great and terrible wars, and then, in the days of those kings, that is, in our day, they saw something tremendous happen. Suddenly their eyes were drawn from earth to heaven. And there in the sky they beheld a great fiery glow as the King of Kings descended in mighty power to bring all the earthly empires to an end. What a wonderful vision! When it was all over, the mighty king of Babylon fell upon his face, and he gave honor to Daniel. He said, "Your God is a God of gods, a Lord of kings, a revealer of secrets. You have told me the truth." And that dream of the metallic image made such a tremendous impression upon Nebuchadnezzar. For though at first he couldn't remember it, after Daniel brought it back to his mind and explained its meaning, he could think of hardly anything else. There was, of course, one thing he didn't like. That was the suggestion that his empire would someday give place to another. He wondered whether that just had to be. Then he had a bright idea. He would make an image like the one he'd seen in his dream, but of one metal, not several, to show that his kingdom would, in fact, last forever. You understand now, not just the head would be of gold, but the entire body and arms and legs and feet and toes, everything would be of gold. He gave orders for the work to be carried out. Oh, what a gigantic image it was. It stood about 100 feet tall. I can imagine crowds must have gathered to watch as the great gleaming idol was carried out of the city and set up in the midst of the plain of Dura. Soldiers no doubt went along to guard it to see that thieves didn't break off its golden toes at night. Everybody wondered what the king was planning to do with so huge an image in such a place. Then Nebuchadnezzar sent messengers throughout the whole of the Babylonian Empire, commanding the princes and the governors and the captains and the judges and the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, all of the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of his image. And one and all they came, tens of thousands gathered on the plain of Dura, men, women, boys, and girls. Suddenly a hush fell over the mighty throng, and a richly dressed herald began to speak. Slowly and in a loud, clear voice, he said, "Whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a fiery furnace." And the band began to play. Just what they began to play, we don't know, from all those cornets and flutes and harps and psalteries, other musical instruments. We're not told that, but as the sound rolled out over the plain, the people with one accord fell on their faces before the image. Nebuchadnezzar felt very pleased with himself. But his contentment did not last very long, because way out there in the kneeling crowd, he notices a disturbance. Some people were standing. "What's the matter?" he demanded. His Chaldean counselors told him that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three young Hebrews whom he had presented not long before, refused to bow down to the golden image. Well, Nebuchadnezzar went into a fit of rage. "Bring them here. I'll teach them to disobey me," he said. He offered the young men one more chance, for he liked these young men from the very first time that he had seen them. The band would play again, and if now they would fall down before the image, then all would be well. But if not, they'd be cast into the fiery furnace. Well, it was an awful moment for these three young men. Nobody liked the idea of being burned. And they could have said to themselves, "Well, just bowing down once won't matter. We wouldn't really be worshiping the image. We'd just do it to please the king." But they did no such thing. They remembered the commandment of God, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." And quickly they answered the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the fiery furnace. But if not, be it known, O King, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. And at this the king became furious. Heat the furnace, he roared. Make it 7 times hotter than it was ever heated before. And the servants ran to do his bidding. Some of them started to throw fuel on the fire, and others worked the bellows to fan the flames to a white heat. Hotter and hotter grew the fire until the king and the whole royal party could feel the heat from it. Throw them in, shouted the king in his wild anger, and the soldiers obeyed. Picking up the 3 young men, they moved forward and threw them into the furnace, and then fell to the ground and themselves died from the terrible heat. Nebuchadnezzar did not care. His foolish jealousy was satisfied. As for the 3 young Hebrews and their God, he was glad to be rid of them. But wait, suddenly a cry was raised. Look, there is somebody in the fire. What? Cried the king. Impossible. But there was. Wide-eyed, with amazement, he gazed through the open doors of this blazing furnace. Well, forgetting his royal dignity, he hurried down as near to the door of the furnace as he dared. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, he cried, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth. And they came. They were not burned in any way, nor were their clothes even scorched. How much the vast crowd saw of all this, we don't know, but we can be sure that the amazing story was told and retold 10,000 times that day. As for Nebuchadnezzar, he was quite overcome by this experience. He never said another word about his great golden image. Instead, he declared to all about him, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him. And then he made a decree that every people, every nation, every language which would speak anything amiss against the God of these 3 Hebrew boys should be cut into pieces and their houses made a dunghill, because, he said, there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. For years, Nebuchadnezzar kept building up Babylon and extending his empire, but of course his downfall was inevitable. Babylon fell as the world empire, and Medo-Persia took its possession in the stead of Babylon, and this was just as Daniel had explained in the prophecy to Nebuchadnezzar. Darius now was the ruler. No doubt he'd heard about Daniel and had been impressed with this Hebrew slave. At any rate, there must have been a very good reason why he, when he made up his government and set up a kingdom over 120 princes, appointed Daniel the first of 3 presidents in charge of them. But the other 2 presidents and 120 princes did not like this plan. They thought it most unfair that anyone who had held an important position in Babylon should now be put ahead of the good, loyal Medo-Persians. And these jealous men did their best to get rid of Daniel. They spread wicked rumors about him, charging him with being a traitor, accusing him of one wrong thing after another, but they couldn't prove their charges. Every time they tried to build up a case against him, it collapsed. Knowing that Daniel never failed to say his prayers 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night, they plotted together to persuade the king Darius to issue a decree that no one should ask a petition of any god or man save himself for the next 30 days. And the penalty? Death in the den of lions. Darius was much flattered by this suggestion, so he signed the decree. And then someone came and told Daniel. Of course, Daniel saw through the wicked scheme at once. But did he alter his lifelong plan of daily worship? No. He had witnessed for God all of his life in this heathen city, and he was not going to give it up now. People were used to seeing Daniel praying at the window, but now they crowded into the streets before the house to see if he would continue to pray. And Daniel went into his house, his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled down upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed, gave thanks as before. Look at him, the people cried. Doesn't he know about the king's decree? The jealous princes hurried to Darius with the story, but it was now too late. The king realized what they had led him to do. He was very angry, but having made the decree, there was nothing he could do about it but order Daniel to be thrown to the lions. And Daniel was arrested, and he was led through the streets to the den